Okay. So again, thank you all. So today I will be speaking on the fourth clear mind precept. I vow to be truthful, not to lie. I'm a bit reluctant to say it, but I did not want to speak on this precept. It made me so uneasy, I actually tried to swap this talk with one or two of the other teachers until I realized that my unease was likely the very reason I needed to speak on it. So here goes. For me, there are many issues that arise in this precept. Lying is a very absolute and strong word and involves judgment. And truth is often a subjective term and likewise involves judgment. Who is doing the judging? Is a mistruth lying? Is holding back the truth a form of lying? Is intentional misinformation lying or just manipulation? Perhaps more to the point in our practice, are we lying to ourselves? Are we being truthful to ourselves? And isn't there a pretty big gap between the two? What if just plain hiding from the truth? Ignorance is bliss, so to speak. And how do we handle the truth? Why do some people think they are better than they really are, or others think so little of themselves when neither are true? It appears that even the concept of what is the truth and what is a lie seems to be changing in our culture. That somehow, rather than truth being a virtue or a scientific fact, it appears to be morphing more to a point of view, something more relative than anything I can remember. Recently, as many of you know, Facebook changed its policy to do away with fact-checking on its social network site. On the day of the announcement, one of the employees responded, "We are entering into a really dangerous territory by paving the way for further spread of misinformation." Meanwhile, on the Financial News Network, a top Wall Street analyst cheered doing away with the fact-checking, saying it would save the company over $2 billion that would go right down to the bottom line for earnings. And that better yet, the end result would be riling up the media, the Meta audience, as the non-censored posts appeared, which would lead to higher viewership and result in more advertising dollars. Not only is misinformation more profitable, but this move was sanctioned in advance by the incoming administration, further standardizing this movement to a more relative truth. I think we all understand intentional misinformation is a form of lying, not free speech, and can result in consequences that can be very, very harmful. We've seen this in the LA fires, in the riots in England, and migrant roundups. Is advertising much different? I'm quite sure many of the miraculous claims or joys of ownership shown to me on the screen are extremely exaggerated. Would buying that car really make me that happy? Is exaggeration a mistruth? When Big Pharma shows ecstatic people with serious diseases delighted in taking their drugs, are they lying about how they will feel or minimizing the very long list of life-threatening side effects in the background? Coming out of college in Texas with a master's degree in economics years ago, I needed to find a job where I could make enough money to get my law degree. I knew stockbrokers did well from one of my sisters who lived in Florida and worked as an assistant for one. So I went from town to town in Florida, interviewing with every securities firm I could find, but got nowhere because I was only 21 and was not settled. So by the time I interviewed at Merrill Lynch in Clearwater, Florida, I came up with an elaborate lie. I created a fictitious fiancé that would eventually follow me from Texas to Florida, where we would start a family. I knew, If I could succeed well enough, I could eventually create another lie of a breakup with my fictitious fiancé and go on to continue my career. It worked. Yes, this was an outright intentional lie. I felt uncomfortable and perhaps a bit ashamed. But at that time in my life, and in that aggressive line of work, I didn't feel all that bad about it. I thought I knew nothing of selling, but there I learned that much of the art of sales was pretending to know, with the conviction and energy to move people to buy something. The truth was less important. I told myself this was temporary, but it turned out I was too good at this. And though I did get a law degree at night school when working at Lehman Brothers a few years later, the day money was too good. I was hooked, even though I disliked sales, which always felt like it was skirting the truth. Speaking of skirting the truth, what of all those white lies, which are easier to tell than long explanations? I need to end the phone call because of an impending appointment or a Zoom call. These can become habitual to the point of not thinking twice. But why do this at all? Isn't this not only not respecting who we are talking to, but also degrading ourselves? And then there are the lies of omission. It might seem easy at first blush to consider omission just another lie, but there can be heartbreaking times when this is not the case. Last year, my brother-in-law was diagnosed with severe lung cancer and life-threatening emphysema. He was only 110 pounds, and clearly it was just a matter of time. He was angry and terrified of death, and his wife and daughter could not accept his diagnosis. Rather than recommending comfort care, the oncologist convinced him he could cure him with radiation and chemotherapy, offering him and the immediate family hope, but not addressing that this would only offer some additional time at an extremely high cost and would not touch the emphysema. He died 3 months later. To me, this was cruel. To Steve and his wife and his daughter, it was their only chance at cheating death with a doctor fighting for them. What of lies of necessity? Norman often talked of the example of the persons protecting Anna Frank from the Germans trying to arrest her, who outright lied to save her as a morally justified lie. I think we all would likely lie to save a life. But there are clearly the lines that cannot be justified, the lies that cannot be justified, which may at first be little noticed or given little attention, and often lead to the worst results. Those of us who have firsthand experienced our lies causing great pain and unintended karmic results of mistrust or physical and emotional pain know the real damage of lies to others and to oneself. The self-forgiveness and asking for forgiveness of a lie is likely one of the most difficult things we can ever do. I must admit, I had a hard time hearing that part of Jean's talk some weeks back on the first pure precept vow, not to create suffering, when she mentions the Buddha telling his son Rahula, if a person feels no shame telling a deliberate lie, such a person won't stop at any evil. Such a person is totally untrustworthy. Well, that's a pretty harsh truth. Earlier, I asked the question, are we lying to ourselves? Are we hiding from our untruths? I find this a difficult question to answer at times. It takes personal courage and deep awareness to clearly see and question one's beliefs and actions. After all, isn't that in part in part, at least, about why we are all here. Norman, in Taking Our Places, says, "The more scrupulously we try to tell the truth, the more we see the truth isn't always such a clear path. As we look more closely at our words, our hearts, our thoughts, our feelings, and our motivations, we become less and less clear about what's true. There's an old Zen saying, everything's true, everything's false. The truth and falsity of this statement begin to impress itself on us as we intensify our efforts to be truthful with our words. It is nearly impossible, most of the time, to know what's true. Reality is so multifaceted that the truth seems to shift and skip and slide around." So where does this leave us from the perspective of precept practice? My understanding of this precept is that in Zen, truth is not just a statement, but a way of being that embodies truth. To me, this means our practice of being in the present moment, of dedicating our life to consciousness of our own actions and taking responsibility for them. To be honest to ourselves and to others, to be humble enough to know that we need others to courageously mirror ourselves back to us so that we cannot be blind to ourselves. To forgive ourselves when we fail and to ask for forgiveness of others we may have harmed. And to be careful of our judgments of others, for events are seldom as simple as they may seem at first blush. Much of what we have been talking about is the relative truth of day-to-day life and our search for meaning in it from our own point of view, which can be very narrow. Norman, in Taking Our Places, talks of the Akira Kurosawa movie, Rashomon, where each retelling of the story is from another character's point of view, each telling a different story, and each seems true. In Buddhism, there is the parable of the blind men and the elephant. Each blind man is given a portion of the element to feel and tell the truth of what an elephant really is. Each naturally has a unique and equally limited wrong idea of what they felt of this strange being from the head to the tail. A water jar, a winnowing basket, a plowshare, a plowing pole, a storeroom, a post, a mortar, a pestle, and finally at the tail, a broom. They were each so sure of what they felt their truth of the elephant was, it nearly came to blows. We are often blinded by our own limited perceptions, our delusions, our karma, to our own notions of what truth is. But there is a larger truth, the truth of our teachings that called us here in the first place, and that we sense in our zazen, that informs our lives and our actions, and that is very much a part of our ancestors' teachings. Dogen says of truth, "Truth is perfect and complete in itself. Not one step leads away from it. If you are unable to find the truth right where you are, where else do you expect to find it?" And Suzuki Roshi said, "Buddhism is not some particular teaching. Buddhism is just truth, which includes various truths in it. Everything is Buddha activity." So it seems we've come full circle. Truth is evasive, yet as Dokken says, it is ever present. We come to know through our mind and our actions our own subjective truth. Yet the real truth of our practice is unknowable, but is ever present. Somehow this makes tremendous sense. We know it in our bones. There is a truth that is beyond our ability to comprehend, yet our own manifestation of our own life's truth is very much a part of this whole truth. We are more than we think we are. Our truth matters. Our actions based on our own truth matters. Yet truth cannot be clung to or attached to because its nature, as all nature, is impermanent. It is not stagnant, but alive, like our Zazen is alive, like our practice is alive. Yes, truth is paradoxical. Not surprisingly, Suzuki Roshi said, "If it's not paradoxical, it's not true." You know this is true in our teachings. Leaping clear of the many and one, you are Buddha nature. You are not Buddha nature. All mind is Buddha. No mind, no Buddha. To study the self is to forget the self. Everything is empty. When you are you, Zen is Zen. When I studied the precepts years ago under Norman, we had no precepts class. He told me to just study them and discuss with him. As I mentioned before in this class, I wrote my own version and added some of my own poetry to try to express to myself my own deeper feelings on each precept. I usually don't share my poetry, though I did once in a precept class a couple of years back. But today I feel the need to close with the poem I wrote 18 years ago, 18 years ago, wrestling with this very same precept. So here goes. Truth. In my limited humanity, I seek truth from the core of my being. The natural consciousness arising moves my soul within deep caverns and depths I do not know. Obstructed by limits of form and senses that create a limited world, I begin in the dark, reaching out to the unknown for the light of truth. Time slows to embrace the present moment, opening there only to release again to the next moment's truth. Without contradiction or clinging, resisting the lure of concept, belief, judgment, opening more. My heart throbs to the pulse of the universe. My breath, the gentle breeze over vast oceans. What is more truthful than a moment of silence? What is more truthful than a moment of silence? So thank you for listening to this. This is my last talk in this precepts class, in this precept series. And as always, thank you very much for your practice. And now I'll just take a minute of silence before John speaks.
Thank you,
Thank you.
We talked several times and told each other how hard we thought this one was, but I think that's what each of the pairs do. You support each other by saying how hard it is. So wanted to start by sharing my screen and sharing a very short 2-minute video. Can you see him? Do you see this?
From my childhood, I have been always good boy. When I became a teenager, I didn't like to be a good boy. To be a good boy, I think it's a difficult task. To be a good boy means try to understand what the people around me expect from me. And I try to do the way they expect from me. So I felt that is not so honest way of life. First, I think other people's mind, and I try to follow their expectation. When I became a teenager and started to practice Zen, I felt I stopped being a good boy. I kind of betray all the expectation from my parents and teachers and Japanese society. So I felt I become a bad boy. But when I became 30, I found I was still a good boy. I wanted to be a good practitioner. I wanted to be a good disciple of my teacher. Or I wanted to be better practitioner than others. I found it's not simply a Buddhist problem, but it's my psychological problem. That means when my body was broken and I couldn't practice, I did in my 20s, so I couldn't be a good boy of my parents, and I couldn't be a good boy as a Buddhist priest. That's why I felt my life was really good for nothing. And so that was kind of very shocking to me. And I was in the process of dealing with this for a few months. And at the time, I live in a small apartment by myself, so there's no sangha, and I didn't need to any practice as a priest. I was just me.
I'm going to stop. I'm going to stop here.
My
Sorry. It doesn't want to stop. He wants to go on. Thought you might enjoy seeing this one here. John, could you mute yourself,
Oh,
please?
sorry.
Like Shohaku, I have to admit, I also wanted to be good, a good child. And I wanted to live up to expectations. I suspect I can tell you the truth that I still want to be good as an adult. And slowly, slowly, that definition of good is changing. And I know that's in a way nothing to do with my will. It has to do with this practice. Little background about Shohaku. He came to this country in his 20s, as he said, and actually injured himself by sitting too long. He was very competitive. And he had a situation where his knees, I think, gave out. And he's never been able to actually sit again in the seated position on the floor. He sits in a chair. And it's been, he says, really good for him, really humbling. Every day he has to face into how competitive he once was. So his smile and his message, I guess, his sincere presence, even in a video, really speak about deep truth to me. They inspire me. I see this wholeheartedness about him. And that video goes on. You can get it on YouTube easily. It goes on with him talking about how he became wholehearted, the long process for him of learning how to live an honest life, how to be truthful. And as we have been reading, and maybe some of you read the words in Taking Our Places of Norman's about when we hear or speak the truth, there's a kind of magical power to it. We all know it when we hear it, and it resonates in our own deep sense of what's right. Whether it's a public talk or in private conversations, we feel it. And we receive it with our whole body, deep in our bones. And when that truth is betrayed or turned upside down, it's really upsetting and shocking. It disillusions us. And sometimes for me, I feel angry. Sometimes I feel like I want to shut down. And I don't want to know any more about it. We know, especially at this moment in our world, our political upheaval and our climate catastrophes, our injustices, our greed. We know there's a huge fire hose of information coming at us all the time, and that it's a tactic of distraction. But it makes the truth harder to find and to clarify, to depend on. We can encounter confusion and frustration, purposeful obstruction, distortion. But even more subtle are rewritten histories, secrets, and silences hiding from us what is really, really true. We know that to receive and give hard truths and to live with hard truths is really difficult. We've all had to do it, and we probably will all have to do it again. Receive a hard truth. Say a hard truth. And sometimes we know it's really unpopular. It can blow up everything in our lives. I remember once when I had to tell a friend that I had seen her husband with someone else. And I agonized about it for weeks. And then I saw them again. And I thought, how much longer can I deceive her? And it really did blow everything up. And then in my own life, I had the same situation happen to me where someone had to tell me they'd seen my husband with someone else. So it can bring us to our knees. We know there are lots of messages about staying silent, even when it has brought us to our knees. But it's really important, we learn this in our Zen practice, not to turn away. Not to ignore the truth or go numb. We heard Norman say in last Sunday's all-day sitting, don't be overwhelmed. Dig deep into practice right now and have some fun, some joy. Appreciate our life. Yes, don't be overwhelmed. That is a tactic to overwhelm. What are we really doing here? What is the purpose of us in this, as Shohaku said, good for nothing practice? This vowing to tell the truth and not to lie. This wanting to be a good boy, a good girl. And yet wanting to also reach for something deeper, something we know, we feel is there. And we may not even be able to say it in words, but we can feel the magic of it in ourselves and in others, the truth. So don't we study and practice in order to get honest with ourselves, to act and to ask with naked honesty and humility, how am I living this life? What's my contribution? What gifts do I have? Spiritual gifts, emotional, material gifts. What do I share? Who am I really? And we can ask our ancient Mahayana Zen ancestors to look from their ancient wisdom mirrors to help us answer the question. They say each one of us is already a Buddha. Don't spend so much time on who am I. The enlightenment we seek is always within us, waiting to be realized through mindfulness, through sitting, through concerted spiritual work. And this truth pushes us toward practice, practice as a whole life, a life of vow, hoping we may awaken our potential even further and to live what's inside of us, already there. I was thinking about some of our ancestors. I thought of Lin Chi, who shook up the Buddhist world by telling his students to drop all their enlightenment agendas and simply be their true ordinary selves. People of no rank. As a young monk, Lin Chi studied diligently and gained an extensive knowledge of Buddhist teachings, the sutras, the commentaries, all of the precepts. He lived a strict monk's life. And he noticed that although many monks also were very diligent, their studies didn't really influence their understanding or their transformation. They appeared to be seeking knowledge only to increase their fame or position in the temple. So Master Lin Chi let go of his studies in order to follow true Zen practice. Many of us have spent our whole lives learning and questioning, searching. But even on the path of enlightenment, all we do is study. We're wasting our time and that of our teacher. This doesn't mean we don't study. Doesn't mean we can't study and practice and help each other. But what's important is not the goal we're seeking. It's actually, excuse me, who are we? Living every moment of everyday life truly and fully. So Master Lin Chi had this solid knowledge of the whole Buddhist canon, but his teaching method was based on confidence that human beings need only to wake up to their true nature and live as ordinary people. That's what attracted me to everyday Zen, was the everydayness of it. I want to say subtle, but also obvious living as ordinary people, teaching of Norman. Extraordinary scholar Norman, who teaches how to live as ordinary people. I wanted to read a little bit of a poem, not one of Norman's, poem by William Stafford, a ritual to read to each other, which seems very important this time. If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others made may prevail in the world. And following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. For there's many a small betrayal in the mind, many a small betrayal, and I call it cruel and maybe the root of all cruelty, to know what occurs but not recognize the fact, to stay silent. And so I appeal to a voice, to something shadowy, a remote, important region in all who talk. Though we could fool each other, we should consider. The signals we give to each other, yes or no, or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep. These signals, yes, no, maybe, are at the heart of practicing each and every precept. There's many a small betrayal in the mind. What is my commitment to living with the vow of ethical conduct? How truthful am I with myself? As John and I spoke these times, preparing our talks, I think we both dared ourselves to be as naked as we could be. And I myself had to confess, I felt sort of overwhelmed in the moment of media blitz. But I also felt that even though there was all this swirling around us, that we have this where we don't have to worry about everybody's expectations. We can just be ourselves with each other. Today I read an article about two sports teams in New Orleans who participated for decades in covering up the names of priests who abused boys for decades in the church parishes. I thought to myself, sports teams, team owners, and the Archbishop of the diocese. Every one of them denying it's true, but there it is, in black and white, in 300 emails of cover-up, subverting the truth. So many people have stayed silent on this kind of issue. I think silence is also a kind of lying. It's certainly not living by vow. It's not the Bodhisattva's way of life. It's not being good. And it's not being awake. It's important. Awake people, being awake. And what we know is that some parents, family members, our neighbors, our community members, even some church elders and Sangha members, even when we're made aware of a situation, we're unwilling to defend those who have been violated. Abuse. People are too frightened or too dependent upon perpetrators to risk a confrontation, to tell the truth. And the power remains with the perpetrators to shape the narrative, obfuscate the truth, retell the story, in order to meet expectations and still look good. We look around here in a Zoom room, and each of us knows that the darkness around us is very deep. We know it's important for us to be awake, alert, not to believe the political lies. Don't believe them, Norman told us. Don't be overwhelmed. Militias feel as if they are now on call, he said. I'm surprised to hear him talk like this. I know how serious it is out there. He said these militias are completely immune and empowered, ready from any time they're needed. And he said the worst thing is for people to be frightened. It'll cause some of us to go numb, to be submissive, because it's just too much. But we can't do that. We really can't be afraid. We have to pay attention. We have to voice opposition when something happens that we are really opposed to. We have to say, just this is not right, not kind, not humane. I am opposed to this. And we have to say that even if it sometimes feels like it doesn't matter, it's really important that we feel it, notice it, and that we say so. If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others made may prevail in the world. Pay attention. Do not let our lives be overcome. Look deeply into the tyranny of living our lives worrying about what others might or might not expect of us. It's really a time for us to take care of ourselves and take care of the practice. Speak up, but also act on your own behalf and behalf of those you love. Have some happiness. Keep our feet firmly on the ground, he told us. Don't hide in a cloud of transcendence or righteousness. Don't hide in your ambition to be important. Let's all let go of being good boys and good girls. Not letting the image of ourselves as good obscure our real Buddha face in that ancient mirror. So thank you very much. So we'd like to now go into breakout groups. John and I each have a question. John, would you like to say yours first?
Yes, mine is, how do you practice with being truthful in your everyday life? How do you practice with being truthful in your everyday life?
Mine is, what are you really doing here? So we'd like to spend